again, as stated within the ordinance, what's required within a fiscal note, the cost associated with the first year and the two subsequent fiscal years, and a footnote for any costs in the future years, which has been provided in the fiscal note provided to this council.
Brian. So, Brian, so you are saying that you have a fiscal note that will substantiate and back up this claim of a 30% average savings or average gross offset by the retirees, an average of 30%. You have a document, a fiscal note that says that, that proves that. I know what it says in this paper I got from the actuaries who are not here to explain it or defend it. Do you have a fiscal note that shows where it is projected to offset gross retiree health care costs by an average of about 30% per year? Do you have such a document?
I'm stating once again, in the event that a fiscal effect commences or increases after this period, the 3 years of the contract, a comment should be made. A comment or period should be made noting this. It was made, and it was noted within the fiscal note.
That's so you're saying over a three-year period, during those first 3 years, that it's going to be able, it's going to show offset gross retiree health care costs by an average of 30% over those 3 years?
I did not say that.
Oh. So what are you saying about the 3 years?
I'm saying we will not have a retiree.
Okay. That will, so there is no mathematical equations or evidence to document or prove or certify how the actuaries are projecting. You're asking, the city is asking us to vote on the contract heavily weighted by this OPEB. And it's saying that this is going to be the first time ever that we're going to have this savings. And this savings is going to average 30% a year. I'm saying, where is the proof? Where is it? We don't have it. We don't see it. And nobody's providing it. Mr. President,
yes.
I want to request a fiscal note showing how that 30% is saved. Where is the average 30% savings per year that is being projected in this document?
Point of order.
Yes,
prior to Councilman Lattiser calling for a fiscal note, I believe that the Council President recognized me. I would like the opportunity to speak.
Sure.
I'll try to be brief. Famous last words. This tentative agreement, I think that we can all recognize that it takes major steps to address the city's problems both in the short term and the long term. There are major concessions both short term and long term here. 4 sick days, 2 personal days, a holiday, 0% raise that first year of the contract, and 2% raises in the second and third years of the contract. Compared to what many other cities and towns are doing, compared to what Warwick did in the past, those are major concessions right there. And there are some great things happening with this new OPEB trust that's being proposed. You know, I have to say that the council president, he laid it out there. He said it like it was, that right now the city has been making promises that are completely unsustainable, promises it can't keep. And I've been talking to people one-on-one, anybody who's in the fire department, city employee, constituents who call me up, and I'll tell them the same thing, that if we keep going down this path, we have these projections, we have the five-year plan, we have the experts coming in every year, and they're telling us that we have this monstrous OPEB liability, and that we are, quote, past the point of no return, end quote. And we're being told that that quote is a technical term. that even if we were to have a maximum tax increase of 4% every single year and put every single penny of that maximum tax increase into funding our unfunded liabilities, we would still run out of money and not be able to keep our obligations. And so without major changes happening, there are going to be a lot of people who have the rug swept out from under them, people who were promised lifetime health care who aren't going to be getting it. And so it might not be the popular thing to point this out, that we're on the wrong track, but it's got to be said. And you know what? This OPEB contribution of new employees in the fire department, 2%, that's not going to solve the problem by itself. Obviously, it's not, and nobody is claiming that it will. But it's a major step because we don't have any OPEB trust right now. We don't have any contribution by anyone toward that long-term liability. So getting that 2% of the pay, which works out to, we're told, about 27%, maybe 30% of those long-term obligations, if that does come to fruition, then that's huge. Now, I do... Yeah. Now, at the same time, I have to agree with my colleague, Councilman Lattiser, that we want to know exactly how these numbers add up. And, you know, I think that everybody in the room wants to make sure that these numbers do add up, because anybody, well, really everyone, whether you're a resident of the city of Warwick or whether you're an employee, active or retired, or if you might in the future become an employee of the city of Warwick, everybody has an interest in making sure that these liabilities are taken care of. It's not just the new employees who, for those lucky enough to be hired and work for the city in the future, this is going to be a huge benefit, because now you have that money in a separate account. It's your money, and it's not going to be taken away from you, if this is all approved, that is. And so you have some safety net there that, no, it's not going to be taken away from you because it is in your account. But we also have to make sure that the purpose of this account is to fund the healthcare. It's not to set up some sort of annuity or life insurance policy or the like that, you know, some 50 years, 60 years after an employee is initially hired, then they get, rather their estate gets a large payout. No, no, no. The purpose of this, first and foremost, is to address this OPEB issue. So it's important that we have the numbers and that it's laid out in the contract to make sure that everyone's interests are protected, that we know that we, how this is going to add up to that 27-30%. Because if it's adding up to half of that, then it's not accomplishing its purpose for anybody. Now, there's been some talk about the arbitration process, and I have to say that something that hasn't really been pointed out is that contract negotiations, people often think of them as a zero-sum game. The city gets X dollars, the city saves X dollars, the members, the union, they get X dollars, and that, well, frankly, that's not how contracts are, not entirely, at least, because there can be those areas of mutual benefit, and a new program such as setting up this OPEB trust is just a huge win for all sides. Now, I would tend to agree with the representations by members of the administration and Mr. D'Amico that it is, in my personal opinion, pretty unlikely that an arbitrator would set up a new program such as this. And so that helps to illustrate how something that's really a mutual win for everybody can't be accomplished in arbitration. And so I do think that the collective bargaining process here, certainly it went on for quite a long while, and certainly every side was doing their due diligence. So I think that there can be mutual wins here, and I think that all in all, this was a contract or a tentative agreement that was bargained in good faith by both sides, and that both sides really fought for their interests and then worked together to come up with something that's mutually beneficial and takes major steps to address everyone's concerns. Now, with that said, there were some concerns that were brought up tonight, as well as concerns brought up in previous nights. Things, well, certainly we talked about OPEB and the Scrivener's errors tonight, but on previous nights, and something that's been looming large in my mind, is the issues of clarity when it comes to the sick time and the monetization of the sick time. I've talked to different people, different members of the administration, firefighters, folks in the firefighters union, and I've gotten some different answers from some different folks on exactly how the sick time payments have worked in the past and how they're intended to work here in this contract. And there are at least a couple of rational ways of doing this sort of thing, whether a sick day, for example, counts so that a 10-hour shift or a 14-hour shift, they both equally count as exactly one sick day, or whether there's proration based on the number of hours, so that essentially the average sick day is worth 12 hours, and on a 10-hour, if one were to take off a 10-hour shift on a sick leave, then you spend 10 hours, and then if you take off the 14, you spend the 14 hours, versus spending exactly 1.0 sick day on both. And what scares me a little bit about the current contract is that you have two different articles. An article that talks about the shifts, Article 4, I believe, and then you have the article dealing with the sick time, Article 8, and they use different terms. So they don't quite fit together. They don't quite mesh. And that problem could be solved by having a pretty simple definition. Maybe it would be two or three sentences that talks about exactly how many hours a sick day is, whether it's exactly how the sick day is taken off, whether the 10 or the 14 hours, and exactly how the sick time is monetized, because especially with this change to the sick days, I don't want to have any ambiguity, and it's that kind of vagueness, ambiguity that led to the problems stemming from the 2012 and 2015 contracts. So especially in light of that, I just would not be comfortable going and ratifying a contract when I don't have clarity on that, and I don't think that's a good service to anybody, whether my constituents or the employees of the city, to have that uncertainty lying out there. So I'll share a little analogy, because some folks know it was recently announced on Facebook. I recently became engaged. And so I was looking, my fiance and I have been looking at some different wedding venues for the reception. So one in particular, we talked to the representative of the facility. We have those conversations on all of those details of planning the event. And yeah, it's pretty expensive. So I want to make sure that the contract reflects exactly what we talked about. And it generally did. But there were a couple of items where it just wasn't entirely clear. So I wrote in those changes, and without getting into all the boring details, I wasn't going to go and sign a contract that would obligate me to all of this money without knowing with certainty, there in black and white, exactly what the obligations of myself and my fiancé are and what the obligations of the venue are, even though I can be pretty sure, I can be 90%, 95% sure that none of these things will actually become problems, but I want it there in black and white. It gives me peace of mind, and also, you know, frankly, I'm an attorney, so how bad would it look if I didn't do my due diligence on that sort of thing? If it ended up becoming a problem, well, that's totally my fault. Similarly, I know that this isn't necessarily something that everybody here on the council or in the audience can relate to, but, well, I know that at least one of my colleagues also graduated from Roger Williams Law a few years ago with me, and so I remember sitting in Professor Margulies' ethics class, and he had a few stories, a few examples that always stood out. But one of the things that he said to me was that the duties, the ethical duties of a lawyer are 24/7 worldwide. It's not just in your law practice 9 to 5, well, 9 to 8, 9 to 10, but it's not just during the law practice. It's not just when you're sitting in the office. It's 24/7, it's worldwide. And while I don't mean to stretch that too far here, because I'm certainly not saying that, you know, there's some kind of ethical duty when it comes to the clarification of this language. What I would say is that I feel like those same duties that I take with my own personal finances, for example, that contract with that wedding venue, I have to apply those same principles when I'm sitting here in this chair, when I'm acting on behalf of my constituents and generally the interests, trying to help with both the interests of the taxpayers and with the city in terms of, frankly, there is an interest in protecting employees as well as protecting the taxpayers. And so I feel that without addressing some of these ambiguities, some of these issues, not with the terms as bargained, but how those terms are stated, how those terms as bargained are listed in black and white, then I'm just not comfortable voting for the contract as it is. And so I would suggest, and I put this in an email earlier, I'm not just bringing this here tonight, I put it in an email back on December 20th, that I strongly suggest and I hope that some of these, or frankly all of these, not just the 5 Scribner's errors, but also clarifying the issue of the sick time and the monetization, addressing the concerns with exactly how the OPEB Trust is set up, how it's funded, so that we know that it's set up the way it should be, that the actuaries' projections of that 27% or that 30%, that we're doing what we need to be doing so that we should be hitting those projections if the actuaries' assumptions are correct. And frankly, there's one last item. There is a provision in which the collective bargaining agreement, the proposed tentative agreement, would bind the city council to change an ordinance to reflect language in a contract, and that's simply not acceptable. That's not something that is the purpose of a collective bargaining agreement. It shouldn't be binding the council to vote a certain way. So really, it's those 5 items that are of concern to me. And if those 5 items, the sick time, the monetization of sick time, OPEB, scrivener's errors and that issue with the binding of the council are addressed. And so really, I'm not talking about renegotiating any terms of the agreement. I just want the clarifications made, and I'm hoping that that can and will be done, because I do want to see this OPEB program. I do want to see this agreement that has both those short-term and long-term benefits, really for everyone. I want to see that happen, but just like I'm not comfortable with signing a contract for a wedding reception where the terms aren't clear, I'm not comfortable acting in my role on as a member of the city council, ratifying a contract where the terms aren't entirely clear. Thank you.
Mr. Pauly. Mr. President, are you going to act on the fiscal note?
Yes. Yeah, and for the record, and as I already informed people, I'm going to call a point of order on the fiscal note request once we get to it, but yes. I understand we're letting people speak first.
So, people that haven't got an opportunity to speak, I'm just letting them speak. Go ahead, Councilman.
Thank you, Mr. President. I have some questions concerning the contract that have not been brought up. Councilman Ricks just brought up something that is similar to what I am going to speak about, but it is not the same. And that is, I understand that the changes in the contract, there are many good things in this contract. I like the fact that the language of the contract was attempted to be made more current, and there were a lot of grammatical changes and things that were more brought up to date. However, as a result of doing that, the contract itself has some inconsistencies. When I was reading through the contract, I saw that time that firefighters work is referred to as working days, sick days for the people that come in to work for them, I guess, vacation days, bereavement days, holidays, day shifts, day tours, night shifts. And the problem is that when all of these changes were made, they never took into account that there should be a definition to tell what exactly the time that a firefighter is working is. What is, I don't know what words to use, but what is a normal shift? What is a working day? I heard testimony that said there's going to be a change to the Boston shift of a day tour followed by a night tour, a 10-hour tour followed by a 24-hour tour. I've heard people tell me that firefighters are going to be working 24 hours straight, and that's going to be a day. I said, it makes perfect sense. It is a day. However, that is not how it is presented in the contract. And I have no problem with making a 10-hour tour and a 14-hour tour equal. You get equal pay for each one that you work. That makes sense to me. I understand that. I don't understand that there is no definition to take away any ambiguity over how this applies to the other terms that I have already read. And that is something that should have been done when all of the language was changed, that the definition section would quantify that and put it in writing. I am concerned over several other sections of the contract, and the something that ties into what I just said is, if a firefighter is called back to work because someone has called in sick, I read overtime, it says that you get paid time and a half for each hour that you work, and it is based on a 40-hour work week. However, the contract is designed to have the firefighters working a 42-hour average week. Why does all of the references to the time that you work is 1 hour is based on a 40-hour week? It's inconsistent. It shouldn't be 1 hour of a 40-hour work week, because that is not what is happening. The question I have, if someone comes back and they're working for someone who called in sick, are they getting paid 1.5 hours for each hour of a 14-hour night tour and 10 hours of a day tour? I don't know. It wasn't put into writing. And if it's not in writing, it's not in the contract. The other thing that is a glaring omission in this entire contract is at the end of the contract, there's nothing called a merger clause. A merger clause says, the contract as written states all of the terms of the contract. Any other agreements that are oral or written have no effect on the contract. We've been burned on that before. We've been burned on that with a fire contract when Tier 1 and Tier 2 were set up, where the city ended up losing an arbitration because a chief had a piece of paper in his drawer that he pulled out years later that said, well, we don't have to follow the, we're not following the timing over when you file a grievance and when you don't file a grievance. Led to an arbitration. It's going to cost the city somewhere $3.5-4 million. That's why I am very concerned about the fact that the entire contract was not made consistent. There are other portions of the contract that I want to bring up. One is on page 69 of the red line contract. They talk about miscellaneous, it's a miscellaneous section relating to something called section 2, a conclusive presumption. It says where an employee is disabled from performing his regular duties as a firefighter because of a heart condition or respiratory ailment, it shall be conclusively presumed that such disability is attributable to his employment as a member of the department. Well, the Rhode Island Supreme Court just said exactly the opposite. There is no conclusive presumption. And I don't know if how that affects the contract. Does that mean that Warwick is going to be giving firefighters rights that every other department in the state does not have, according to the Supreme Court of Rhode Island? Their recent ruling was pretty clear that there is no presumption. There is certainly not no conclusive presumption. Another thing that I saw in the contract that caused me some concern was the payment for time that firefighters do for civic and non-civic duties. I have no problem with firefighters getting paid whatever they can get when they're performing non-civic work. when some companies hire them to do work when they need to hire a firefighter. However, the civic part of it causes me concern, because that means one part of the city has to pay the firefighter at least 1.5 times their pay in order to perform duties at a school function. If it is on certain days, it's double time. And the double time section adds 6 quasi-holidays to the list of holidays that firefighters have. And on page 26, those items are laid out in the contract, where if they, 26, and up, that's a Christmas. No, yeah, no, that is it. Page 26 makes July 3rd a holiday, October 31 a holiday, Christmas Eve a holiday, and New Year's Eve a holiday. The other 4 days are the 4th of July and Christmas Day, New Year's Day, and Thanksgiving Day, which are already holidays. But those other 6 quasi-holidays, the city would have to pay the firefighters for a civic duty double time if they were called to work at a, say, for example, Thanksgiving Day, if they needed a firefighter. I don't know if they use firefighters or need a firefighter for the Thanksgiving Day football game that is done by the school department. But if they did, it would have to be at double pay. I don't think that civic and non-civic should be combined in the same section. I don't think that there should be extra holidays put into the contract in a different place from where the holidays are. The Boston schedule says that it's supposed to start on January 20th or January 1st of this year. Well, it didn't start on January 1st of this year. Obviously, the contract that we have that says that is going to be faulty. That cannot start until it starts. And there are other dates. It's supposed to be a 1-year trial. And on December 31st of 2020, and the city has the option of going back to the old shift, the old work schedule. If we go back to the old work schedule, how is that going to change the language concerning what a day is? If we're going to only do this for a year, this contract does not say that the changes that are being made for the Boston schedule would change to be consistent with the old work schedule. That is something that nobody foresaw and wrote into the contract to say what would happen. Because if a shift now, a 14-hour shift is the equivalent of a 10-hour shift. If we go back to the old schedule, what is a shift? What is a day? What do you get paid for? I don't know. I can't get an answer from this contract. And if it's not in writing, it's going to come back and it's going to bite us very bad sometime in the future. I think the step of having firefighters contribute to the OPEB is a good thing. It is a good part of the contract. However, it is a baby step. And one thing that it's not going to do is give any consolation for the people that are paying taxes in the city of Warwick now. It may be good for their grandchildren when it becomes to be something that is saving money for the city. It's easy to pass on this positive baby step to the next group of people that are hired. I would have been a lot more excited if we had heard that it was going to apply immediately and that the current members of the fire department were agreeing to do this. That would have been something that the actuarial bean counters could have gone to and given us an answer that this will reduce the burden on the taxpayers that they have to face every year immediately. But that didn't happen. But I know that there are faults with the contract, and I know that I heard the city solicitor say it before. This is not a Scribner's error. The fact that we don't know how these terms are going to be applied and what they mean. These are real things that will lead to real problems, and unfortunately, the taxpayers that are currently paying the taxes are not the ones that's going to see the benefits for the next generation or the generation after that. And I know change is hard, and making improvements in government is like watching a glacier move. It's really slow. I don't know who wrote that section about the contract being able to somehow change a city ordinance, or magically, I guess, because it would have to take work by the, it would have to be someone on the council that's going to put it forward, and to write into a contract that if anything is contrary to the contract that's in the city ordinances, then the city ordinance is null and void and shall automatically be amended to be consistent with the contract. That's not the way it works. The only thing we have before us tonight is an up or down vote on this faulty piece of paper that I have in front of us. And the only one that can change the city ordinances are the city council. Whoever decided to put that into the contract certainly had more chutzpah than I do, because I know all I can say is yes or no. The way this contract is written, there is no way that I can get behind it and say that it is a good final contract, knowing that these errors exist. And the errors exist beyond what can be called in my language, typographical errors. If you want to call them Scribner's errors, fine. But I've heard what our council has said, and I know that we cannot change it. What should be done is it should go back and those changes should be made, and someone should address the unanswered questions over what was created when this contract was changed to bring it up to date for the wording, and we should have definitely a clause at the end that says if it's not written in the contract, it doesn't exist. It's a simple merger clause that takes about 30 words to put in. And if you look at your credit cards or you look at your mortgage that you signed when you went to the bank, you'll see it. It's in every contract I've ever signed. I understand that. Why it has never been put into the city contracts is simply poor work on behalf of the city when they agreed to it. And I think that has to change. Thank you.
Do any other council members have anything to say? I know Mr. McAllister has his hand up. And I know that Councilman Lattisaw had raise the issue of a fiscal note, which I'll rule on in a second, but go ahead, Mr. McAllister.
Thank you. Know that we are definitely getting way down in the weeds here, but what is before us tonight is what we were tasked on. We have a yes or no vote. This is a negotiated package that is a series of compromises between two parties. There's parts in here that I like and there's parts that I don't, but as a councilman, I have to look at this as a whole. We can't change a comma on this. So I think we should take a step back and look at what's in this contract. We talk about the wages. In this contract, 0% for the first year, 2% raise in the second year, 2% in the third year. This will save the city over $400,000 in the first year. The union gives back 7 days to the city. That's one holiday pay, 4 sick days, 2 personal days. This saves the taxpayers money. There are structural changes for when new firefighters obtain certain grades. It takes an additional year for them to move up to the next grade. This will save the taxpayers additional money. We have the 24-hour shift schedule. This should reduce overtime costs. However, if it does not, the city can go back to what we have now. But the thing that should be highlighted is that this is the first time the city gets management rights to decide the best shift schedule for the taxpayers. This contract settles the Tier 2 issue. It puts it crystal clear in the contract. The city lost on this issue. We moved forward and we lost. This will settle it once and for all. This contract has an unprecedented OPED trust for new hires. New firefighters will pay 2% each pay period towards their health care costs and retirements. This should be an example for other contracts going forward. If we had started this process 20 years ago for new hires, we would be in a much different situation. This contract also cleans up language on unused sick time payouts, which will save the city money. I also think we should discuss what happens if we were to vote no. If we were to vote no tonight, this entire agreement is null and void. We go back to arbitration. Everything negotiated in this TA goes away. It's not like the city gets to keep all the things that are in this contract now and go back and ask for more. The only thing guaranteed in arbitration is legal costs to the city. We could lose all the givebacks I listed. Plus, we could put the taxpayers on the hook for much more costs. For example, in this contract, there's 0% raise in the first year, 2% in the second year, and 2% in the third year. If this goes into arbitration, that number could become anything. It could be 3% in the first year, 3% in the second year, and 3% in the third year, because other contracts have had that. There are also other issues out there, like minimum manning increases, which could have a huge increase the cost of the taxpayers. No 3-year contract is going to undo years of negotiation in contracts. Everyone in this room understands healthcare costs need to be addressed. This contract starts addressing healthcare costs for new hires going forward. But we won't stop there. I am willing to work with this council, the mayor, the fire department, and the taxpayers to come up with a plan to address this issue. We all need to come together, and everybody should be at the table. Tonight before this council is a fair contract that is negotiated, that has compromises from both sides. There are a number of incremental improvements that puts the city in a much better situation than we had before. Going back in arbitration, losing all the negotiated gains would be a huge gamble of the taxpayers' money. Therefore, I believe this contract puts us in a positive direction, and I will be supporting it tonight.
Councilwoman Travis. Councilwoman Travis.
Thank you. Councilwoman McAllister said most of the stuff I was going to say, but the bottom line is it's a yes or a no vote. A no vote means we're not going to be going anywhere with it. Where we are now, we're not going to be going. If anything, we'd be going backwards. A yes vote is definitely going to be saving taxpayers now. And we got to, people are hurting now, so we need it now. And Mr. President, I would like to move the question.
Okay. So Mr. Sinapi, did you want to say anything? Or?
You want me to do that first or do the point of order first?
I don't know if you wanted to make comments regarding...
I did. I have questions, too.
Sure. Go ahead.
So a few things. One, Councilman McAllister touched on it briefly. Comparatively, the salary increases that we're seeing in this contract. So let's assume that the arbitration decides that the increase for the ones not covered by this contract will be, let's say, 3%, the highest possible, because this contract would cap it. This contract would then give us a four-year average of about a 1.75% salary increase. Compare that to Central Falls, East Providence, Johnson, Providence, as far as what their fire departments got, it blows them out of the water. It's way lower. Obviously, a better deal to the taxpayers. Not to mention, if you just look at the other CBAs that the council, prior to me being elected, approved, gave way higher tax increases. And if people want to understand, if people have issues with their taxes, you got to look at those. And that's why this one is important, because going forward, you're not going to see that kind of issue where people get screwed because of that. That goes away. This has a blueprint for going forward. And if OPEB is touted as the biggest deal, then this trust should be touted as a huge win, especially when arbitration, you ain't getting a trust. No one has a trust in this state. Why the heck would an arbitrator ever give us one when it's unheard of? It's ridiculous. On the merger clause, I'm not sure you can even have a merger clause, given that the TA is part of this. You can't say this is the only agreement, but P.S., there's another agreement. I don't think you can do that, but that's for a lawyer to decide, not for me to decide. A reminder, the council has no negotiation power whatsoever. I don't know. It seems to be that there's a large misconception in that regard. We cannot dictate the terms. I think it's clear that most, if not all, the council people would like certain things written a certain way. That's fine. That's our prerogative. There's no doubt that we are allowed to have that opinion. We are not allowed to dictate terms. If we wanted to do that, we would have had to have changed the charter, which is our prerogative, is our ability, but was not done, was not proposed, and still to this day is not proposed, despite the fact that everyone's harkens back to when the council got burned. Furthermore, I have a few questions for Attorney Bragasta, if he's still here. Howdy, and as a preface, I should point out that I bothered to read the arbitration decision. It's like, what, some 50-something pages that people keep forgetting is going to become a problem for us if we turn this contract down. And some have mentioned, maybe not tonight, but at least at the first meeting, the fact that they think we have a chance on appeal. Read the record for the arbitration. We don't. We have nothing. That's my opinion. That's also the opinion of a lot of labor attorneys. And when I asked, attorney's been doing this long that I've been alive, he said, if Attorney Ragusta says you don't have a chance, then you don't. So I guess I should ask. Attorney Ragusta, first, how long have you been practicing public sector labor law?
I'm in my 41st year.
Longer than I've been alive. So I say that's a bit of experience. Are you considered one of the senior practitioners of labor law in Rhode Island?
As a pure labor law practitioner, with the exception of Joseph Penza, who's a union side labor attorney, I guess I am in that group.
So as far as attorneys in this room, between you and Attorney Penza, you are the authorities as far as labor law experience?
I would say that we probably have more combined experience than any other attorneys in public sector, grievance arbitration, interest arbitration, unfair labor practice litigation, litigation before the Superior Court to either confirm or vacate arbitration awards, one of which I happened to look at, had with Mr. Connolly when he represented the IAFF maybe about 13 years ago on what constitutes a sick day. So yes, we have a lot of experience. Mr. Connolly does as well.
Can you explain to the council and the general public what is interest arbitration and how it exactly differs from grievance arbitration?
Interest arbitration essentially is a process by which the union and the employer have essentially lost control with respect to the formulation of their agreement. They are going, it's a legislative process, they are going to an arbitration panel to have that panel look at the respective proposals and decide what the contract, the labor contract, commonly known as a collective bargaining agreement, should contain in terms of all of the terms and conditions of employment on mandatory subjects of bargaining. So it is a process under Rhode Island law, in the case of firefighters, that is governed by the Firefighters Arbitration Act in Title 28, Chapter 9.1. And I could speak for hours about how it actually works because I've been doing interest arbitration on behalf of cities and towns, the state, Rhode Island State Police. I've served as an arbitrator, both partial for employers. I've served as a neutral arbitrator, most recently in the Rhode Island State Police interest arbitration. And I've presented cases on behalf of municipalities, quasi-public corporations, and so forth. So in a nutshell, an interest arbitration is a process where the impasse between the parties in bargaining is then sent to an arbitration panel, and that arbitration panel essentially decides what the contract will look like and how the taxpayers' money will be spent. In essence, you lose control over what your contract will be like because it's subject to the decision-making of the arbitrator. And there are statutory guidelines as to how decisions are to be made. And I should speak about that just briefly, because the arbitrators are required to consider a number of factors: a city's ability to pay, comparability evidence with respect to other municipal fire departments. And that is very challenging because, as you mentioned earlier in your opening remarks, when you look at other fire departments and you see salary increases and you see certain benefits, to some extent, the fire labor organizations in this state have created a virtual cartel, if you will, with respect to that comparability data. So when Warwick goes into an interest arbitration, or Providence, or Cranston, or any other municipality, a town, a smaller town, you're basically stuck with, if you will, what is out there in terms of other municipal collective bargaining agreements. And then, of course, there are other factors such as hazards of employment associated with firefighting, and a host of other factors that are generally not listed but arbitrators rely on based on common law of labor relations. So it's an open-ended process, and as was alluded to earlier by, I think, Councilman McAllister, and I make no bones about this, lawyers, court reporters, arbitrators, expert witnesses, such as actuaries and financial consultants, they're the winners in this process. I don't like it. I don't like the process at all because it is a gamble. It is a huge gamble. You've turned over the checkbook to an arbitrator, usually someone with little ties to Rhode Island, other than coming to Rhode Island to practice as an arbitrator and generate income. So it's not a good process.
Right, and the standard for appeals, arguably even worse. I mean, it's the worst I've ever seen as far as, correct me if I'm wrong, that the standard to overturn an arbitrator is that they have to correctly identify and state what the law is and then basically go the opposite way. And if they do that, then you have an appeal. You have a valid appeal.
Yeah, there are two types of challenges based on the two types of arbitration. With an interest arbitration that I just have talked about over a resolution of the impasse with a three-member arbitration panel decides the contract terms, that's only reviewable by writ of certiorari to the Supreme Court. Essentially, what that means is that the court looks at what the arbitration panel has decided as to what the contract will be in terms of all of the terms and conditions of employment. And the court will look to whether or not the panel of arbitrators acted within the general scope of authority that's been given to them under the Firefighters Arbitration Act or the Municipal Police Act or the Municipal Employees Act, etc. A grievance arbitration award, such as what the City of Warwick was confronted with and is confronted with in the Tier 2 case, that standard of review is highly deferential, and as recently as, I think it was December 9th, the Superior Court of Rhode Island issued a case,
case in
the City of Cranston, where they raised challenges on the substantive arbitrability of the dispute, i.e. whether or not there was jurisdiction for the arbitrator to hear the issue in the first place, and then also on the merits. And in an opinion written by Justice Nugent, he cited a number of Rhode Island Supreme Court cases that are quote-unquote well-worn, well-settled law, that there is a presumption of validity in those awards. And absent fraud or a manifest disregard of the law, not a mistake of law, but a manifest disregard of the law, the arbitration awards cannot be overturned. And that is true even if the reviewing justice of the Superior Court believes that the outcome should have been different, or the legal analysis of the arbitrator is in some way flawed.
Yeah, I think the Lane case pointed that out. They said if this had been before us on the arbitration issue like normal, it actually would have went the other way. But now that it's here in this method instead, now we can actually rule.
Yeah, again, one of the problems with litigating an application to vacate the Tier 2 award is there's a huge downside risk to this city if there's a loss. If the Superior Court and the Supreme Court of Rhode Island apply the standards that it normally has over a subject matter of pension, which has been well examined by the Rhode Island Supreme Court and the federal court, that's a mandatory subject of bargaining. Tier 2 would never materialize. What this settlement does is it obviously puts an imprimatur by the union and the city on the implementation of Tier 2, albeit belatedly, but it puts that problem in the rearview mirror. And I think, as I said on December 16th, had I been involved representing the city back in 2011 or 2012 when this council laudably embarked on pension reform, I think I would have advised both the council and the administration of a different approach in terms of what needed to be done. And I know Attorney Penza had alluded to that as well, that if he was involved and there were a negotiated agreement on pension reform, there's a way to do it. So process matters, and process was not followed. And I think that is something that everybody in this room ought to think about. Again, this brings closure to the issue. It's not perfect. It is belated, but it brings closure, and it's a step forward.
And you kind of alluded to a few of them, but what are the downsides if we do not ratify this CBA? What risks do we face?
Well, on a practical level, based on 41 years of labor relations, I can tell you this. If you go the distance, and mind you, this Solomon administration is arbitrating proposals that it did not conceive, create, or proffer in negotiations. They were generated by the prior administration. And we're also arbitrating and defending in this process proposals made by the Firefighters Union to adopt recommended NFPA standards on upstaffing all apparatus to include engines, ladders, and rescue companies. There's no community in Rhode Island that has that mandated in a contract as a result of either collective bargaining or interest arbitration. That would be a major shift in the paradigm of staffing in this community. And that would have tremendous impact, negative impact, both fiscally and otherwise on this city and this department. That is a gamble that, quite frankly, is one that the city should avoid. I'm a little bit reluctant to say more because this is an open forum, and normally I talk about collective bargaining and arbitration strategy in a closed forum. But there's been a lot that's been put out there, so I can tell you this. The fact that the firefighters are backing off on that, I have confidence that we could put up a defense. I have confidence that the defense would be meritorious. But what I cannot tell you, as someone that has done more interest arbitration on behalf of cities and towns than anybody that's currently practicing law, arbitrators are a big gamble. And the arbitrator that we have in this case has had a number of his grievance arbitration awards vacated. I consider him to be a decent arbitrator. I think he's thoughtful, but he's highly liberal. And I'm watching the testimony come in, I'm watching his reaction, and I must say, it leaves me a bit uneasy. And that perception that I have is based on years of reading arbitrators that work as neutral arbitrators and watching them. So that is one huge downside risk. And to the credit of the firefighters here, they have been willing to back off that proposal. And they backed off that proposal taking a zero, a two, and a two. And as I think as others have pointed out, that is a very modest settlement, at least in terms of percentage increases to salary. So, and by the way, one general comment, you talk about zipper clauses or merger clauses. There are some in Rhode Island, but if you look at firefighters' arbitration, firefighter collective bargaining agreements, you do not see many zipper clauses or merger clauses. And that is a factor that arbitrators have to consider in the decision-making process. They have to look at comparability evidence. They have to look at whether or not zipper or merger clauses exist in other labor contracts for fire departments. And while my brothers at the bar correctly point out that merger or zipper clauses are common in commercial clauses, contracts, wedding venue contracts, you should have one, by the way. They're not so common in municipal police, fire, or public sector contracts. I propose them. I have been successful in getting them in some communities, but they are outliers. They are not the norm. And as far as the imperfections, I'll be the first one to tell you, there are imperfections in any contract, including this one. But this contract that is passed upon tonight and vetted by this council is incrementally better than what existed. The job is not done. This is a step in the right direction. There's much more work to do. The firefighters sitting here tonight, they know me. They know that we will make another run at them. They know that when we bargain a successor to this, there will be more proposals to reform this contract. But where we are right now at this juncture, it makes eminent good sense to resolve this, resolve the Ryan Tier 2 grievance arbitration as has been negotiated, and put this to rest. The job is not done, for sure, and it's not perfect, and there are imperfections. There have been a lot of good points made, but I could go through any municipal contract. I could go through any private sector labor contract. I could go through any individual employment contract and find flaws, questions, so-called Scrivener's errors, typos, ambiguities. There's an ambiguity, as a famous U.S. Supreme Court justice has said, ambiguity lurks in every word, in every syllable. So one can seek to make an ambiguity anytime, but whether or not that's going to hold up, that's a matter of litigation. So we're off to a new paradigm, if you will, in labor relations, I hope.
Thank you. And just some closing points. some closing points. One, for those who think all attorneys are, you're an attorney, therefore your opinion on this is just as valid as another attorney's. I was recently even corrected in this regard myself. A labor law attorney is a very specific kind of attorney. For instance, if you run into an employment law attorney, they are not the same, because one corrected me on this topic today, actually. Very different. And as Attorney Regusta pointed out, it's also when it comes to contracts, too. One contract and another contract are by no means alike, and you shouldn't compare them apples to apples, because they're not both apples. Far from it. A contract to get something done, like a wedding, is very different than a CBA, whether we like it or not. CBAs are notoriously complicated. There's ample federal law on it. Like it or not, this city, under a prior administration, has given away the farm, the animals, and the homestead. We have to chip away at that piece by piece. You can't just take it all back all at once. It's not possible unless your city is in a fiscal emergency, which we are not in one, thankfully. That is a good thing. It's not a bad thing. People should be happy about that. You shouldn't be sad just because you can't take away everything from CBAs that was given away that arguably shouldn't have been. We're working with what we have. We should be very happy that the firefighters were willing to give so much and that the administration was able to get as much as they could. Go and ask any of the other unions or any of the union members you know, any of the heads of unions especially, and ask them whether or not this makes sense to them, whether or not they never would have given away this stuff. Good luck. It's going to be an eye-opening conversation for you. As others said, this is a roadmap, and unlike with other CBAs going forward, there won't be any litigation leverage. So those who are concerned with the contents of this contract, feel free to look out for them, how the next ones come about. I also have two motions in addition to my point of order. It's just a question of which one you want to handle first.
I just wanted to comment on what you said then.